This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture with me, Lim Soo Ann. The internet has afforded us access to more information and online materials than we could ever imagine, but it has also provided a space and anonymity for child pornography, or more accurately, online child sexual exploitation and abuse material to be uploaded, accessed and shared. Now, recently it was reported that the Royal Malaysian Police had received more than 93,000 IP addresses suspected of sharing such material on the internet over the past 6 years, but that they lack the resources to carry out arrests and inspections. So what can we do to better tackle online child sexual exploitation and abuse? Here to help us dive into this is Trividya Ganapati, lawyer and co-chairperson of the CRIB Foundation. Welcome to the show, Sri. How are you doing today?
Thank you so much for inviting me, Sue Ann.
So we're talking about quite a heavy subject here, but just to make sure that, you know, we and our listeners are clear on this, right? What constitutes online child sexual exploitation and abuse material, or CSEA, under our laws?
Right. So in Malaysia, under the relevant governing legislation is the Sexual Offences Against Children Act 2017. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the terminology of the Act is child pornography. And the definition of child pornography is in Section 4 of the SOACA. But I have to say that when we formulated this provision, we did a pretty good job, because the definition is pretty wide. So it covers any representation in whole or in part, whether visual, audio or written, or even if there's a combination of visual, audio or written. And it's not just limited to electronic, mechanical, digital, optical, or magnetic means, but it's also like, so long there's any kind of imagery of a child engaged in sexually explicit conduct, or even and our acts, our laws even cover where it's an animated image of a child engaged in sexually explicit conduct. It also covers things like videos, and you know, I'm just to throw this out there, you'd be shocked to know that on YouTube, for example, you can actually find videos where Spider-Man is engaged in sexually explicit conduct with Cinderella, for example. You know, and obviously that is stuff that's targeted directly at children. So yes, it doesn't have to be an actual person. It could even be a cartoon, it could be a drawing, it could be writing. All of it is covered under our laws.
Hmm. And correct me if I'm wrong, Sri, but someone could be charged for either making, possessing, or even sharing such content. Is that right?
Exactly. And those laws are covered under Section 5 to Section 8 of the Sexual Offences Against Children Act. It also covers something. I mean, I think a lot of Malaysians are not aware of this. But if you, for example, receive a WhatsApp image, mm-hmm. For example, a few years ago, I think there was this video that was making the rounds of a child sitting on a man's lap and he was fondling the child. And that actually comes under child pornography under the Sexual Offences Against Children Act. And if you as a person who has been forwarded that WhatsApp image, right? If you, for example, share it with your friend and say, look at this, this is terrible, but you're actually exchanging child pornography, that is also an offence under the law, under Section 8 of the SOACA. Yes.
That's quite terrifying to think of. And I will ask you later, what can someone do? But first, right, you know, this news reports of CSEA, of child sexual exploitation and abuse materials, news reports of these cases happening aren't uncommon. You know, every few months we see reports coming out, or, you know, whether locally or coming from internationally. But do you think that the availability of such material, or the sharing of it, is something that people take seriously, especially when we see that it's not uncommon for people to sexualize children or to make such comments against children, right? And I think quite recently we saw that in the case of Ain Husniza as well, where people made sexual comments about her, a child, do you think that's something people take seriously?
In Malaysia, take a very jokey manner. We don't really take it seriously. And I think there's a lack of education and awareness about this. I don't think that people understand the implications of child sexual exploitation and abuse materials on a child, for example. You know, when we talk about pornography, it's generally like what we would call a blue movie, right? So, you know, that's the general perception of what is pornography. So you think of consensual recordings of people engaged in sexual activity, yeah? However, with child sexual exploitation and abuse materials, where it's a physical recording, right? So if it's of an actual child, then that every such recording is actually evidence of a child being abused, and then that abuse being recorded and being shared or whatever. And people don't really understand that. And that there are horrific examples of what kind of child sexual exploitation and abuse materials are out there. But people think of only the lightweight things. You know, they think it's a girl posing sexily, for example, or a boy posing sexily. But it can, I've, for example, been shown images of a baby, of 6-month-old baby, being penetrated with a penis, and that is one of the things that constitutes child sexual exploitation and abuse materials, you know? I've seen videos where small children, maybe 5 to 8 years old, are engaging in sexual activity. They are actually having intercourse, they are engaging in oral sex, but because the law says that a child under the age of 16 for girls but under 18 for boys cannot consent to sexual activity, any such recording is definitely abuse, number one. But number two, children are at an age where they are eager to explore, happy for adventures. And so children will not know that they are being abused sometimes. It's not always that the sexual abuse is something that's painful for the child, or that the child will even be aware, hang on, this is not right, I'm being abused. That's not always the case. But we don't really understand all these levels in Malaysian society, I feel. And that's why there is this predominant view that actually child pornography is okay. They don't really think of it as child sexual abuse and exploitation materials. They think of it as pornography. So it's just another category.
I'm speaking today to lawyer and co-chairperson of CRIP Foundation, Sridhya Ganapati, on online child sexual exploitation and abuse materials, or what is described under our laws as child pornography. We'll be right back after a few messages. Keep it here on Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture with me, Lim Soo Ann. On the line with me today is Sridhya Ganapati, lawyer and co-chairperson of CRIP Foundation, and we are discussing online child sexual exploitation and abuse, or CSEA. Now, Sri, it was recently reported that since 2017, the police had received more than 93,000 IP addresses of people suspected of sharing online child sexual abuse materials, but the number of arrests and investigations that were made, you know, paled in comparison to the number of reports they received. Now, ACP Siti Kamsiah Hassan of the D11 division also said that they needed more trained staff to filter and scrutinise the information they received. And from your experience in the field, Sri, what are the challenges that we do face when it comes to clamping down on people making and sharing or accessing these child sexual exploitation and abuse materials?
Right. I feel that one of the challenges, the main challenges that we are facing, is that our police frontliners and our prosecution officers who are framing charges for offences, I feel that they have not been adequately trained on child sexual exploitation and abuse materials. They have not been adequately trained on child pornography provisions under the Sexual Offences Against Children Act. And therefore, they're not actually able to investigate or prosecute adequately. This is what I feel. And I will explain why I feel this way. I'll give you an example. About 3 years ago, one of my clients came to see me with this information. They are an international company, and their head office in Europe had contacted them to say that one of their office laptops was being used to download child sexual exploitation and abuse materials in Kuala Lumpur, right? So what this company did was, their head office in Europe was able to give them the IP address and to tell them these are the number of downloads that's happening on this laptop. So the Malaysian office, what they did was, with the IP address, they located the laptop in their office. They confiscated the laptop, because child sexual exploitation and abuse materials is understood throughout Europe and America, even Australia and New Zealand, and you know, throughout a large part of the world, people already are aware that this is an unforgivable crime, and there are huge penalties, not just on the person who's downloading, right? But even, for example, in this situation, if it's your employee and he's downloading something on your office laptop, the company can also be prosecuted, right? So it's a huge offense, and people are very aware of it around the world. In Malaysia, it is similarly an offense if a company fails to take action when they know that their office computers are being used for child sexual exploitation and abuse materials, for child pornography. This is something that most Malaysian businesses don't really know. Most Malaysian employers don't really understand. But because my client was an international organization, they knew, and they taking the lead from their European head office, they confiscated the laptop. They took the laptop to the police station, and they lodged a police report. They said, "We have received this information that this laptop has got child sexual exploitation and abuse materials. This is the person who's the user of this laptop. This is his identity. We have all of the evidence, and our European counterparts are willing to assist you with this. Please let us know how we can help." And they lodged the police report. Nothing further happened. So my clients came to see me, and they said, "Is there anything that we can do about this?" And I said, "Okay, let's write to the police, and let's write to the to ask them what's happening." And we wrote several letters, but until today, nothing's been done. That's it. And it's due to a failure of the frontliners not being trained in the SOACA and not being trained in child pornography provisions to understand, and also a lack of awareness, not just among Malaysian public, but even among our frontliners in the police stations, in the Attorney General's chambers, that this is a serious offence and that you must prosecute people when you find evidence of it. I feel that that awareness is not there. For example, the average Malaysian now knows that it is an offense to overtake a police motorcade, for example, but probably they don't know that if I exchange child pornography materials or child sexual exploitation and abuse materials, that that is against the law.
So now there have been calls for more funds, or at least funds that were allocated during Budget 2022 to be channeled immediately to the D11 division. This was also echoed by MPs like Batukawan MP Kasturi Pato, that funding such as these need to be expedited. When it comes to training, how much do funds help? And is that enough? You know, what else can be done to improve awareness about online child sexual exploitation and abuse, especially among law enforcement officers?
Right, that's a really good question. And I'm sorry, but the answer is in several parts. So the first thing is, I do agree that there should be more training provided to police officers throughout the country, on the issue of child sexual exploitation and abuse, not just child pornography, but child sexual exploitation and abuse, we do need more training to be given around the country. See, what we need is a situation where every police station in the country or every district in the country is able to cope in the same way that, for example, we in the Klang Valley are able to cope. You know what I mean? It should not be that if you come to, if you go to KL, you get D11 officers who are trained to take your report. But then if you go to some small town, you don't get the same level because they might not have a D11 unit. But what I do know is that we don't have, at the moment, we don't have D11 units throughout the country. We don't have them in every district in Malaysia. And, you know, Malaysia means Peninsula Malaysia and Sabah and Sarawak. So for a fact, we don't have D11 units through every district in throughout Malaysia. And that is a problem. So yes, I agree. We need budgets to be allocated for this. We need more officers to be trained. We need more D11 ground units to be set up. Meaning to say, we need the frontline officers to be trained to take reports in respect of child sexual exploitation and abuse. We need officers to be trained to understand that, oh, this is against the law under the SOACA, and therefore I can arrest this person for this offence. They need to understand that child pornography offences are against the law, for example, right? So we need that kind of training for police officers. We also need the same kind of training for prosecution officers, junior prosecution officers who are like framing the charges. They need to understand it. But I don't think that we need to have more officers in the cyber unit, you see?
Mm-hmm.
Because the cyber unit, I mean, it's online. It's a cyber unit. Australian police are coming and telling Malaysia, look, you are having this guy downloading or uploading child sexual exploitation images online. I mean, they are in Australia. So you don't need to be based in every, you don't need a cyber unit to be based in every district in Malaysia, you know. You just need a central office in Kuala Lumpur. And I believe that the police have an excellent cybercrime unit. And so I, in my personal opinion, the cybercrime unit can handle this based in their location, wherever they are in the Klang Valley. They don't need to have a cybercrime unit or a MICAT unit in every part of Malaysia. That's my belief. Because this is online, you can see that other countries around the world are able to track. Why can't we just be in one location and track? But what we need is people on the ground who are able to identify. Once a report goes to them, they're able to identify and they're able to take action. Meaning to say, if in, let's say the MICAT unit is based in Bukit Aman,
mm-hmm.
and the Bukit Aman officers identify, okay, we have a guy downloading things, uploading child sexual exploitation and abuse materials in Kulim. All they have to do is contact their Kulim counterparts in D11, and D11 will go and, you know, do the necessary to arrest and charge. That's what we need. We need those guys in around the country to be trained.
Hmm. When it comes to funding as well, there's the matter of allocation, right? And you want to make sure that you're allocating funds to the right people. And, you know, I think what you described does, you know, I think people can picture what you're describing, because what you want is people on the ground who are able to respond to these very sensitive issues in the right way, right? You don't, especially when children might be involved.
I just want to add to that to say that this kind of training mm-hmm. should be done consistently, because, you know, within our government service, we do have this policy of transferring officers around the country, around different job scopes. So we want the frontliners to constantly be trained, so that even when they get transferred, there are new guys who are coming in, they are also trained. But also these guys who are promoted, they take that information with them, they take that knowledge with them. So there is this learning, this process that's going on continuously, where all the time we have trained police officers and trained prosecution officers who know about the SOACA.
Mm. Now, we've been talking about the crime, the criminal side of things, right? If we turn to look at the impact on the children involved in making such child sexual abuse materials, what are the concerns for their well-being and what kind of support is needed to be provided to these kids when such cases are found?
You know, I have read stories of people, adults, who in the course of their life stumble on videos documenting their childhood sexual abuse. And they are then re-traumatized and they go through that horror and the hell of it all over again. The child sexual exploitation, child sexual abuse has an impact not just on the person's body, on the child's body, but completely on the child's mind. And there's scientific data to show that it child sexual abuse can lead to a prevalence of diabetes, cancer, depression, increased tendency to commit suicide or intentions to take your life. And they actually lead even further, they lead to lost working hours and an impact to a country and the GDP because it actually deteriorates your mental health. Mm-hmm. So there's so many implications that a child will face throughout their lives. You can never step away from the horror. You may forget, you may learn to cope, you may learn to adapt, you may learn to go on with life, but it is something that a child will carry on throughout adulthood, throughout their years. And to have that documented, right, to have that abuse documented and to have it floating around somewhere on the internet, for example, the horror is sustained, and the thought that someone that you know, if you are the child, the thought mm-hmm. that someone that you know may see that video or that imagery of you, the thought that people that you're working with or your family members or your children or your friends or your loved ones might stumble on an image of you when you were a child being traumatized like that, I mean, that can lead people to desperate things, to desperate thoughts. And we don't really have any kind of support mechanisms in place for survivors of even child sexual abuse in Malaysia. It's very much ad hoc. Like, there are many NGOs that try to provide on-the-ground support, but really we don't provide, for example, mental health support mm-hmm. to people who have reported child sexual exploitation or child sexual abuse. We only take their report. We, in fact, further victimize them when they go through the criminal justice systems because we treat them a lot of the times like bahan case, you know. They are not told what is the outcome of the case. They are not told whether the perpetrator is out on bail. They are not told what is happening. And then when they go for the trial of the case, they are cross-examined to such an extent that they are made out to seem as if they seduced the other person. You know, that there's a whole bunch of trauma that is revisited on the child when the child opts to go through the criminal justice system and take the perpetrator to court. And throughout that whole process, we don't have in place any state-funded mechanisms to support the child.
And like you said, right, Sri, the impact, you know, even if we provide mental health support, it cannot just be in the short term because the impact is long-lasting way into adulthood.
Yes. And you know, I'm very sad and sorry about this state of affairs, but usually, right, especially if the perpetrator is someone known to the child or someone that the child is living with, like her parents, then what happens is the child is then removed from her environment and placed in care.
Mm-hmm.
So she loses, she's a victim, and then she's re-victimized because she loses everything that she knows. She's taken away from her school, moved to a different location, put in a hostel or an ashrama or a shelter, and it's doubly horrific. It's like that person gets re-traumatized again and again. And then they grow up into adults with this whole scarred insights and nobody there to help them or to help them to cope, you know?
Mm.
It's very sad.
I think what really strikes me about how traumatizing this could be is, like, we know with a lot of things that we put online, it's forever, right? And with something like this, to have something so traumatic forever be online, that must be such a terrifying thing to live with.
It's hell.
Mm. Now, Sri, you've spoken a lot about challenges when it comes to the training of law enforcement staff, but how much does the nature of the online space, the anonymity and the ease of access make it difficult to tackle online child sexual exploitation and abuse? How much does that factor in?
I think that with technology, I mean, it's a constant battle. Mm-hmm. It's a constant struggle, right? But I think that we have advances in technology to the extent where internationally we are seeing that local crime enforcement, I mean, like, for example, the Australian police are doing a tremendous job, and they are not just restricting themselves to their own shores. They're actually scanning the dark web. So there's something called the dark web, which mm-hmm. is not the web that we go on, because whatever said and done, the web that we are on, if there's any kind of reports of child sexual exploitation or abuse materials, you can actually report it and then it will get taken down most of the time. But then there's this thing also called the dark web where people can upload things, and there's a whole community of users who are on that, who are downloading or uploading, or and they are consuming that kind of materials. So that's definitely a challenge for law enforcement. And I also know and have heard that police officers who are engaged in this, the cybercrime officers, they go through severe PTSD because of the trauma that they have when mm-hmm. they view those images on a daily basis. So it is definitely challenging. But we have progressed in the last... I mean, we are so much more better off now than where we were, let's say, 5 or 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Evil is out there, and it's there's no way that I can say to you, yes, we have been able to conquer the evil, or we are able to do this. It's a war, it's a battle, and there's always evil, and all we can do is say we are going to do better, and we are going to improve, and we're going to do the best that we can. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Is there a role for internet service providers to play when it comes to, I guess, blocking or detecting cases of child sexual abuse material being shared online?
Right. So in Malaysia, at the moment, we don't have laws requiring our internet service providers to block or remove.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no actual regulations on our internet service providers. But for example, if you look at Digi, and they are doing a wonderful job. I'm not a Digi subscriber or sponsored by Digi in any way, so there's no motive here. But I'm saying to you that Digi actually takes down child sexual exploitation and abuse materials whenever they see it or they find it, and they are very, very proactive about this. They actually go out there and they teach people about it, and they tell them, be safe, keep your children safe. And I think they're doing a remarkable job. And I think it's about time that our other internet service providers also stepped up their game. And even though we don't have legal provisions in place in Malaysia currently, I think that this is an obligation and a responsibility that all internet service providers have.
Mm-hmm.
And they should take that as their corporate social responsibility and act up on it. I mean, just because DG is international doesn't mean we can't be international in our mindsets in Malaysia.
Hmm. And so earlier, Sri, you were talking about how some people don't realise that they are actually committing a crime when they receive WhatsApp videos being forwarded to them, right? What should people do if they happen to come across online child sexual exploitation and abuse materials? You know, what is it something that they should immediately report to the police or report to the provider? What are our options here?
You have
have to make a police report. You have to inform your if it's on Facebook, make a complaint. If it's on TikTok, lodge a complaint, and delete the video and do not share it. Because every time that you share that video, you are also adding to the trauma of that child. What if the person that you share it to shares it to the child or the child's parents?
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine the horror of it? That you find out that your child was sexually abused because you received a WhatsApp video from your friend. Can you just imagine that kind of trauma? And the thing is, most parents will not know. Most parents will not know that their child is being sexually abused or exploited. And a thing that's going around nowadays is where children themselves are generating the images. And just to give you a very quick explanation for that,
mm-hmm.
it's where someone befriends them online or even physically and gets the confidence of the child and says to the child, can you take a photograph of you when you're bathing? Adik boleh hantar tak gambar adik? Then adik hantar gambar, saya pun hantar gambar. Or boleh tak adik hantar video? And there's videos that are circulating where children are photographing themselves or children are videoing themselves and sharing it. And parents will not know. Parents, every child has got access nowadays to, mm-hmm. You know, to streaming, to devices, to the internet. It's a thing. We have to stop it. And the way that we as ordinary people can stop it is to stop forwarding, to report, and to report to the police. Do it.
Hmm. From the parents' perspective, right? What can parents do to protect their kids from being exploited or being groomed online?
I always advise parents to remember that your children are not terrorists. Your children are, in fact, your teammates. I mean, if you, as a parent, that's the one thing that I would tell you. Your child is not a terrorist. Your child is your teammate. Now, if it's a terrorist, why am I saying this? What, mm-hmm. what is the context, right? If it's a terrorist, let's say you're in an American movie, right? And you are in a hostage situation and then you are fighting your way out of, let's say, a locked area. And you know there are terrorists there. There's information that you will not share with the terrorist. If you find the terrorist device, you will go through it and you will try and hack into it and find the information there. And you will do your best to block that terrorist from doing certain things. But you will share what's happening with your teammates. So you will tell your friend, okay, this guy is in this place and that's where we're going to be bombing. And that's what we're going to be doing. And the same thing is with regards to online sexual exploitation and abuse and your children. What a lot of parents do is they take their children's phone and they check their phones. They check their Instagram profiles. It's the equivalent of those days checking your children's school bags lah.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not good enough because firstly, your children are cleverer than you when it comes to being online. There's so many ways that you can hide information on your phone. For example, if you have a video of a video that you don't want your parents to see, you can park it behind calculator apps and so many other apps that pretend to be innocuous things on the outside. Parents will not know how to find those things. Children have multiple Instagram accounts where they have certain accounts where they just share with specific people and their parents are blocked out of it. So if you're going to treat your child as a terrorist, that child is better equipped at terrorism than you. And there's no way you can help to fight that. But the only way you can do it is you can sit your child down and speak to your child and say, look, there's happening in the world. This is your body. Your body is precious. You have to understand that when you are sharing your images, these are the things that can happen. People can blackmail you. This is happening a lot now, where children are being blackmailed into having sexual intercourse or you know, oral sex or whatever, because someone has a compromising video or photo of them, which the child themselves shared with this person. So all you can do is you can educate your children on the risks out there. You can have proper, candid conversations with your children where you're talking to them about what is happening in the world and how precious they are and how important it is that they understand their body autonomy, they understand their body parts, they understand that sex is an important thing and sex is not something that you undertake lightly. We really, really need sexual and sexuality education in school. Like, urgently. We needed it yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm. And on that note, thank you so much for joining me today, Sri.
Thank you so much for having me and for having this very important conversation.
I've been speaking to Srividya Ganapati, lawyer and co-chairperson of CRIP Foundation, about challenges with tackling online child sexual exploitation and abuse materials. If you missed any part of today's show or any previous Live and Learn episodes, you can look up the podcasts on bfm.my or on the BFM app. I'm Lim Suen, and this has been Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.